We'll hear arguments first this morning in Marine Bank against Samuel Weaver and others. Mr. Miller, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case involves two separate and distinct instruments. One, an FDIC-insured certificate of deposit in the amount of $50,000, bearing interest of 7.5% and maturing in 6 years. Secondly, an agreement between a loan customer of the bank and a guarantor of the customer's loan to the bank, about which the bank had no knowledge at the time the loan was made. Petitioner Marine Bank requests that the Court reverse the judgment of the Circuit Court, which found that both instruments were securities within the meaning of the definitions of the 33 and 34 Acts. The FDIC insured certificate of deposit is not specifically mentioned as an enumerated item in the 33 and 34 Act definitions. However, the Circuit Court of Appeals applied several tests. One, the any note test, and secondly, whether it was an investment contract. In the investment contract issue, the Howie case decided by this Court clearly establishes what the test is and has been since 1946. And that test was further elaborated upon by this Court in the Cherepin case decided a few years later. And that test being, a document is a security if it's a contract, transaction, or scheme whereby a person invests money in a common enterprise with the profits to come solely from the efforts of others. We believe that that test has been misapplied by the Circuit Court, and there are three Circuit Court decisions in the Fourth, Fifth, and Seventh Circuits: the Burris case in the Fourth, the Bella case in the Fifth, and the Finglin case in the Seventh, which hold that certificates of deposit are not securities within the meaning of those cases of this Court. Is it any note? The statutes say, unless the context otherwise requires, any note, and so forth. Is the CD any note? In this event, we'd like you to address the matter the way you did in the Daniel case, which looked at the substance of the transaction and not what it is called. If you look at the substance in Daniel, as you did, you found that a pension plan document did not establish a security. Now, the Third Circuit here said that this was functionally the equivalent of a corporate note. We don't believe that that's correct. A corporate note contains an earnings risk and a risk of repayment. This FDIC secured certificate of deposit does not have a payment or repayment risk, being an insured deposit, and it has a fixed rate of interest.
Mr. Miller, you haven't mentioned the facts. You don't have to because we know what they are. But you represent the bank here.
Yes, I do.
These old people are out there $50,000, aren't they?
Well, there was recovery, Your Honor, Mr. Justice, against other collateral, but there would be a substantial portion of that lost. Yes,
is the officer of the bank who handled this transaction still employed by the bank?
Yes, he is.
Without reprimand?
He has not been reprimanded, to my knowledge. I believe the Third Circuit erred in its analogy, calling this an investment contract. The Cherepin case held there was no voting in the fact as to whether there is or is not a voting right connected with the instrument is important. In Cherepin, that was a savings and loan certificate which contained the element of voting. The CD contains no element of voting.
Well, are you saying that in Cherepin the thing was more like a share of capital stock?
Yes, it was more like an investment in the savings and loan. The savings and loan had no other investment vehicle other than selling shares or investment certificates, as they were called in Cherepin. But in this case, the bank has, of course, capital stock issued pursuant to the Pennsylvania banking laws, which is where the investment would be in this case.
And you don't question that would be a security?
That certainly is a security. The legislative history of the enactment of the 33, I believe in 34 acts in the congressional hearings, one of the representatives of the banking industry clearly said that the stock of a national bank would be an investment. In looking at this, you might think of it as to whether it's a commercial instrument or an investment instrument. We believe that commercial instruments are not covered by the securities definitions, and investment instruments are. Legislatively, the 33 and 34 acts were part of a package of acts that were enacted in those years and which regulated banking in several respects. One was the Glass-Steagall Act, and another was the FDIC Act. Now, those acts provided a parallel system of regulation of banking in this country, that is to say, federally regulated banking institutions through the FDIC or the Comptroller of the Currency. The legislative history of the Glass-Steagall Act shows that there was an attempt, when it was passed, to separate banking from investment activities. And the Third Circuit, we believe, erred in blurring that distinction and putting it back together again. The respondent, Weaver, does have a remedy. The Pennsylvania Securities Act, as referenced in the complaint of the respondent filed in the district court, does claim account under the Pennsylvania Securities Act where there's essentially the same language as Rule 10b-5. Also, there's a Pennsylvania common law fraud count alleged. Both of those are pendant claims, and so there is a state court remedy in this case.
And has a state action been instituted?
Yes, it has, Your Honor.
And what is its status?
We understand it's been filed. I don't know whether it's been served.
I didn't get the letter.
I understand it has been filed. I do not believe it has been served.
No question the statute of limitations or anything?
I wouldn't express an opinion on that. There probably is a question on that. Is the Picarillo agreement an investment contract? I think there are four elements of investment contract that need to be looked at. One, is there a multiple investor situation? There is none here. Is there a pooling of funds? There is none here. Was there a public offering? None here. Was it solely from the efforts of the promoter, Picarillo? No, for two reasons. This agreement provided that Mr. Weaver could pasture his cows and use the barn of Mr. Picarillo. And secondly, and very most importantly, he could veto any future loans in Mr. Picarillo's business. So it was not solely from the efforts of the promoter, Picarillo. Even if, and I don't admit that it is, but even if this Picarillo agreement is a security, the bank had no knowledge of it. The depositions of both Mr. Weaver and Mrs. Weaver, reproduced in the joint appendix and quoted in most of the briefs, clearly established that they did not tell Marine Bank of the existence of this side agreement between them. And Marine Bank, therefore, cannot be held under the Ernst & Ernst case decided in this court as an aider and abettor in the securities fraud which has been alleged. We can't predicate 10b-5 liability on the alleged negligence of failure to inquire about something we didn't know was there. The closest case in the circuit courts is in the Fifth Circuit, the case of Woodward versus Metro Bank, decided about 5 years ago. Whether a CD or the Picarillo agreement is or is not a security is a matter of law and not a fact. The circuit court erred in reversing the judgment of the district court and remanding for trial. A motion for summary judgment was and is the proper method to resolve the issue of jurisdiction. The broad security definition cited by Judge Gibbons at the conclusion of the Third Circuit opinion is clearly an error. The SEC agrees, as do the other regulatory authorities, as to the result in this case. Under the analysis of Howey, Shrepman, and Daniel cases in this court, these two instruments are not securities and cannot be the basis of 10b-5 liability or a 10b-5 claim.
Mr. Connor?
Yes, sir. Good morning. To understand this case, the posture of this case is to understand some of the factual background. I think, simply stated, Sam and Alice Weaver go to the bank at the bank's request. In early March of 1978, they have acquired a $50,000 certificate of deposit a couple weeks ago. Prior to them going into the bank, they've already been solicited to make an investment in the Columbus business by the bank. And in early March of 1978, they in effect traded the certificate of deposit, the $50,000 certificate of deposit that they had, which was of a maturity of 6 years, which you undoubtedly understand is critical because it gets it outside the exception within the 34 or the 33 Act that has the 9 months exclusion. And they traded that for this particular agreement that is an investment position in the Columbus business. All of these events occurred within a couple days of each other or a couple weeks of each other, and one was the consideration for the other. In other words, they trade their certificate of deposit for the right to obtain the profits from Columbus. And a critical thing here, the bank's involvement, is that the bank induced this transaction for their own benefit. And the reason why it was to their own benefit is that they, in effect, were a risk lender to Columbus and unprotected at the time. And the reason why they're unprotected is they forgot to file their equipment liens properly in the right county. So, in effect, they had a $30,000 or $40,000 loan outstanding that they couldn't collect. Columbus is insolvent at the time. Columbus is overdrawn at this bank in a checking account. In other words, there is a checking account, and they're overdrawn. I think the record indicates way back in 77 that they had been overdrawn. They've been overdrawn continuously. The bank kept on honoring their checks to keep them afloat, if you will, to keep Columbus afloat, so that they could stay in business, so that they could figure out a remedy to this problem, because the bank couldn't collect on their loans because they hadn't perfected their equipment. So as a consequence of that, they had told Columbus, Mr. Piccirillo, to go get an investor. And they introduced, Mr. Piccirillo introduced Mr. Weaver to the bank because the bank, in effect, was approving whoever was going to get in business with Mr. Piccirillo. And Mr. Weaver, in February 1978, refused to get involved in the business. He refused. He said it was too risky. He didn't know Columbus's financial status. So what happened was then the bank, realizing that Mr. Weaver was going to be the way that they could enhance their position, that is, that they could get their overdrawn checking account solved and get the loans taken care of, went out and actively went after Mr. Weaver to get involved in Columbus. And they solicited him out of his farm, and they finally persuaded him to come in with his certificate of deposit and pledge it. And they told him that if he pledged the certificate of deposit, they would loan Columbus $65,000. And substantially all the $65,000 would go for working capital. This was perceived by Mr. Weaver to be a safe investment. It was perceived by Mr. Weaver to be safe for many reasons, one of which was the fact that the bank told Mr. Weaver that, in fact, the bank had filed proper liens against Columbus's equipment, and they were protected, and they had sufficient collateral to protect Mr. Weaver. Those three statements, affirmative statements by the bank, were false. They weren't going to lend Columbus $65,000. They were going to take the $65,000, just as they did in this case, and pay themselves off, leaving little or no money for Columbus. And the second and third statements were false, that is, that they had perfected liens because they filed them in the wrong county. It's a quirk here. Columbus is right on the county line between Erie County and Warren County, and the bank's main office is in Erie County. And in any case, they filed the equipment liens in the wrong county, so they were unprotected. That was false, and the third statement was false. Third representation that they that there was sufficient assets there that if anything went wrong with Columbus, that Weaver would collect. Now, perceiving that to be a safe investment and a safe transaction, that's what Mr. Weaver in effect did. He came in, he pledged it, and a couple days prior to that, he had agreed to take this profit sharing agreement with Columbus. Now, you got to understand the fact that there is absolutely no question we're here under a Rule 56 motion, summary judgment, and the facts are to be construed favorably to the Weavers. The Weavers are elderly people. Mr. Sam's over 80 now. And to reasonably expect that he was going to actively participate in this business, a slaughterhouse business, which is hard physical labor to generate any profits, it's just unrealistic. And those facts are to be construed in our favor.
Mr. Now, Connor?
Yes, sir.
Supposing the Weavers had simply come in and purchased a $50,000 certificate of deposit and then later been dissatisfied or thought there were fraudulent misrepresentations in connection with it, would you contend that was a security?
I would say that it was literally within the act, but in the context of that transaction, may not be a security. The distinguishing factor in this case is it is a secondary transaction that we're complaining about. We are not complaining about the original issuance of the certificate deposit. And this distinguishes many of the cases that are have been decided in this particular field. We're complaining about the second transaction, that is the transaction which was the transaction which he trades that position for an investment position. And I think that there's a distinction between the primary issuance situation and the secondary transaction. I think in the primary issuance transaction, it may literally fall within the note or bond, or if you're within the 33 Act, within the term evidence of indebtedness. But within the context of that particular issuance, it may not be a security transaction. But in the secondary transaction, and we've cited the case, the Meeson versus Bank of Miami draws that distinction, which is a Fifth Circuit case. There is no Fed second citation because it's so recent. It's a August or October, September of 1981 decision. I don't think there's a Fed second citation.
Mr. Conner, I asked your opposition whether a state claim had been filed.
A state claim has been filed, but there is a statute of limitations problem there, specifically because there is a one-year statute for securities violations in Pennsylvania. And in this particular case, we have a pendent state court claim attached to the federal claim, and the motion for summary judgment in this case was not filed until the eve of trial, which was a couple of years after the events here, and hence we would be late with regards to the any securities violation in the state court. Even though it's been filed, we have a procedure in Pennsylvania where we file by a summons. So there is a substantial statute of limitations defense.
Well, are you conceding that that defense is a good one?
I'm not conceding that.
But you haven't pursued the state claim?
We have not pursued the state claim. That's correct. We have, as you undoubtedly know, in this particular case, the Third Circuit had directed the district court to hear the pendent state court claims in this particular case. That was part of the order, the reversal in this particular case, was to hear the pendent state court claims. And under the authority of Rosada versus Wyman, which was decided by this court, the pendant claim, considering all of the equities and the circumstances, can be heard by the district court no matter what this court would do with regards to either the securities contentions in this particular case.
Mr. Conner, is there a state common law fraud claim as well as a securities act?
Yes, sir.
And is there a one-year statute as to that claim?
I believe there's a two-year statute.
The same problem of limitations?
Yes, sir. Going back,
Mr. Conner, I didn't understand. Both these state claims, you say, are pendent claims in any event?
Yes, sir.
Are they too subject to a statute of limitations?
Well, not in this particular case. Yeah. They wouldn't be if they were resolved by the district court because they were timely pled with the original federal securities claims.
In other words, if they were decided as pendent claims, even though state claims, there'd be no statute of limitations.
That's correct. But if we were forced...
Well, that's because they were filed in time.
The pendent state court claims in this case were filed timely.
Yes.
The problem was that after the statute had expired in the state court proceedings and just on the eve of the trial of this particular case, the court granted summary judgment on the entire case. And the district court in this particular case dismissed not only the federal securities claim and also dismissed the pendent state court claims. Now, going to the question of the certificate of deposit made reference to by the bank in this particular case. I think that a change, that is, if the court would hold that a certificate of deposit is not a security, that would be a change in the law as opposed to the contrary. And the reason why I say that is this. The National Bank Administrator has specifically told the presidents of the National Bank back in 1967 that time deposits, according to the SEC, were considered securities within the anti-fraud sections of the 1933 and 1934 Act. And that reference is made identified specifically in the Federal Register and made reference to in the amicus briefs. So the national banks, at least since 1967 up and through the present time, have been on notice that certificate of deposits were, in fact, held to be securities within the anti-fraud sections of the 1933 and 1934 Act.
Did the administrator express approval of that construction by the SEC or simply note it?
Your Honor, I think it was just noted. It didn't say one way or the other. It just said in so many words that the SEC at that point in time had taken the position that the deposit and share accounts are subject to the anti-fraud provisions of the Securities Act of 1933 and 1934. And this was also made reference to in the you might have a question as to whether or not the time deposit would be a certificate of deposit within that context. And in the Superintendent of Insurance versus Bankers Life, the district court so indicated, did not express an opinion as to whether or not a certificate of deposit was a security, but so indicated that that's what they were alluding to. So if the court would, it's our submission in this case, that if you would hold to the contrary, that it's not a certificate of deposit or that it's not a security, that that would be a change in the law, because considering this has been out, we would submit that the banks have been on notice, at least since that time period, that certificate of deposits would be considered securities within the anti-fraud sections of the 33 and 34 Act. One other point.
Counsel,
that I think,
has the SEC ever changed its position on that?
To my knowledge, they have not. And to my knowledge, the best answer that I can give to you with regards to that is that the SEC in various cases have appeared amicus, taking various positions on whether or not a CD in the context of a transaction is a security. For example, in the Mason case versus Bank of Miami, they appeared amicus, and in that case was a secondary transaction. They contended it was a security within these acts. And I think in the Burris case, that after there was a Burris case that came down, that originally held that a certificate of deposit was not a security. They filed amicus, and subsequently that decision by the court was withdrawn. So at various times they have appeared amicus and contended that a certificate of deposit is a security.
How do you account for the Solicitor General's brief then in this case?
I account for it in the following. I think they filed a joint brief.
That's what?
A joint brief between the FDIC, the SEC, and the Comptroller of the Currency, and I think they take the position that it's in the context of this transaction as opposed to the literal question about whether or not it's a security for all purposes. And I would say that it sounds like, maybe it's just my guess, that they got outvoted between the other people that vote there in the government.
Well, Mr. The Chief Counsel of the Commission is on the brief.
I understand that, but they say specifically in the brief, they say specifically that it's only in the context of this transaction and not a question whether or not in other cases, because they're very careful to say that in other cases they may take a different position.
I thought they said that about the contract.
No, sir. They said that with regards to the CD. Mm-hmm. One other thing I think that the court should be aware of is the fact that the opposition has indicated that it's the fact that the certificate of deposit is not mentioned specifically in the definition, that would indicate that because it's not mentioned specifically and or because they mention the word certificate of deposit for a security, which we acknowledge is a different instrument, that would be some indication that a certificate of deposit was not meant to be literally within the Act. This court in Joyner, in a very similar issue, specifically held that type of analysis was incorrect. There is a reference to oil leases, for example, in Joyner, and the question was whether or not a divided interest in oil leases as opposed to an undivided oil interest in oil lease was a security. And the court held that just because they were making reference in the statute to a undivided interest and that they did not mention a divided interest, that did not mean that the divided interest was held to be or would be held to be a security. In fact, the court so held.
Now, Mr. Conner, let me call your attention to page 6 of the government's brief here, where they say at the end of the first full paragraph, the conclusion that the certificate of deposit involved here is not a security subject to the anti-fraud provisions of the federal securities laws, harmonizes the federal securities and banking laws, and avoids overlapping jurisdiction that would, quote, serve no general purpose, close quote, citing our Daniel case. Now, that, I had taken that as a fairly explicit statement of their position.
Your Honor, my understanding is on page 6, if you'll see that the right down at the bottom of paragraph 2, it says examination. Excuse me, I'm sorry. My understanding is that in the brief here, and I have lost a particular point where they've said this, that in this particular brief they so indicate that they did not want it held for all purposes.
Well, on page 22, I thought the government's position was that where you have a regulated bank, you just don't treat CDs as securities. It's they didn't want any general rule about certificates generally in unregulated areas. But with respect to a bank that's regulated, I thought they just said put it aside. They've already – the other laws will take care of this, not the securities laws.
Well,
is that right or not?
I don't think that's right. I don't think that that's their position. I think that because it would be inconsistent with the SEC's position in other cases, and specifically the Bank of Miami case that's so recent.
That may be, but what about on page 20, beginning of paragraph 4? That just repeats what Justice Rehnquist said. And then it says the foregoing analysis, however, may not necessarily apply in other contexts.
And they say the better reasoned decisions of the lower court do not view the question whether a certificate deposit is a security in the abstract.
No, but they, I thought their position was if you're dealing with a regulated bank, the answer is clear.
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor. My understanding is that they are not taking that firm of position because obviously certificate deposits can be traded in all sorts of secondary transactions, and I think that they recognize that, and I think that if they came out hard and fast, that there would be all sorts of secondary transactions, and we just differ on the facts in this particular secondary transaction as to whether or not it formed a consideration for an investment position.
What are the practical advantages of proceeding under the Act as opposed to in the state causes of action?
The one primary practical advantage is the fact that in the securities law, that is in the 10B case or the 17 case, it includes omissions as opposed to commissions, that is, situations where a party fails to disclose, and on this, as would apply to this particular case, Your Honor, it would apply to a situation where the misrepresentation was purely misrepresentation by silence, where they failed to tell people something. In this case, there is that element in that. They failed to tell the Weavers, for example, in this case, that Columbus was insolvent and was going to be insolvent even though they went through this loan transaction.
And under state law?
That may not be a cause of action under the common law of Pennsylvania because the common law draws a narrower line with regards to what is actionable fraud. I think the distinguishing factor with regards to this secondary transaction that we differ from the government because I don't think that the government analyzes the facts in this particular case to identify that the bank specifically identified Weaver as an investor. They, in their testimony in this case, specifically identified Weaver as an investor as opposed to a guarantor or proposed guarantor. They said he was an investor, one. Two, they said that he was making an investment transaction They testified to that in their pretrial depositions and were entitled to the benefit or favorable construction of that, and said that. They never said that he was just acting as a guarantor. And thirdly, they specifically identified the amount of his investment as being $50,000, and they so stated in the record in this particular case. Now, separate and apart from the certificate of deposit issue is the related issue of the Picarillo agreement as to whether or not that constitutes a security within the securities law. We would submit that it fits within any one of the one, two, or three definitions within the subspecies of security, such as profit-sharing agreement, certificate of interest, or, in fact, an investment contract. And the Court has laid down basic guidelines as to whether or not a particular agreement constitutes an investment contract, whether or not you have an investment of money, whether or not it's a common enterprise, and whether or not there's a reasonable expectation of profits from the efforts of others. And I think clearly in this case that we meet all of the elements. There is no question about it that there's a $50,000 investment. The bank, in fact, so stated that was the channel which the money was being channeled into Columbus. And there's little question that on the facts of this case that the profits could be expected from the efforts of Picarillo and not Weaver. There's absolutely no evidence that he was going to do anything that was going to contribute to the profits in this case. The bank argues that it's not a common enterprise, but the $50,000 investment of Mr. Weaver is pooled. They say there's no pooling. It's, in fact, pooled with the assets of Columbus. It's not separated. It's commingled. There is also another question about whether or not in this particular case, considering the bank is in an unsecured position, their assets are pooled there too. And there were other people who were loaning money, the original seller of the business. So if there is a question about just the multiplicity of investors on a vertical standpoint as opposed to a vertical standpoint, as opposed to horizontal, excuse me, as opposed to a vertical standpoint.
Mr. Connor, yes, can I ask you a question? If one owned farmlands and leased the lands to a farmer, the compensation to be a division of profits or a share of the profits under the lease arrangement, would that be analogous to the contract you are discussing here this morning?
That is, the landowner leases it to the farmer?
Yes. And the compensation to the landowner is a share in the profits. A very common arrangement.
That may be. I think there's a distinction.
And the distinction is?
The distinction is that in our case, we are providing capital at risk.
What about the land that, in the example I put?
The owner gets the land back. And we don't get the certificate of deposit back if the business fails. We lose it. Where the owner of the land gets the land back, He has not made an investment at risk like Mr. Weaver does in this particular case.
Suppose the lease is for 10 years.
If there would be certain leasehold rights that he would have the right, assuming that there's a written lease, he would have certain rights to take the land back. Eventually, he gets, Your Honor, I would submit that he would get his land back, and he would does not make the commitment that an investor makes when he provides capital at risk that Mr. Weaver does in this particular case. This particular case, the only chance he's going to get his deposit back is if, in fact, Columbus has sufficient working capital to make it.
In the example I put, the owner of the land might receive no profits whatever for years.
That's a possibility.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Well, supposing, to modify Justice Paul's example a little bit, supposing in addition to the arrangement with the tenant who would work the land and provide a profit, they then pledged or mortgaged the land to the bank and borrowed the working capital to buy the farm equipment. Then I suppose you'd have the same case.
You're getting closer to that particular case. And I'm sure that you can draw arrangements that get closer and closer to this particular situation. And I think that we meet all of the elements. The court said that they were not dealing with a full record in this particular case, and the question before the Third Circuit was not whether or not, after a full trial, whether or not we had met the full definitions of an investment contract or a profit-sharing agreement or a certificate of interest, if you will, but whether or not there was a genuine issue of fact
as to whether or not we met those requirements. And we would submit that on the record before that court and on the record before this court, there's certainly an issue of
fact. Are you saying that as to make the investment contract aspect of this case a security, you must have as a part of the overall transaction a pledge of the certificate of deposit?
Yeah, but that's correct, Your Honor. See, the original idea of this whole transaction was Mr. Weaver was just going to give Picarillo $50,000. And then he backed off because of the risk involved, and the bank became concerned and went back and told, well, listen, there is a less riskier way of doing this. You give us the $50,000 CD, we will loan the business $65,000. And the bank was doing that, you see, because that was the only way at that point that they could solve their own problems. And from Weaver's standpoint, it seemed like a relatively safe investment. Because he sees somebody who he trusts is the bank, and they're telling him that they have this equipment protected, that they're going to give him $65,000, and the bank themselves said that Picarillo needed $10,000 to make it, and the bank knew that he wasn't going to get $10,000. He got $3,800 out of a $65,000 loan. Now, there was just no possible way that Columbus was going to make it, that they were headed for insolvency or bankruptcy, irrespective of this loan transaction.
Well, if the bank had made representations about this company and convinced the people to make a loan directly to the company, same result? Say he took back a note from the company.
Certainly the courts have held that risky loans, a long-term loan at risk is a security. The Second Circuit specifically, I believe in the Zeller case that's made reference to in the briefs, have indicated that long-term loans like that are
security. So any note issued by a borrower is a maybe a security?
No, I didn't say that. I'm sorry. I didn't overstate it. It's a loan that's at risk. Where the only chance of paying it back is a profit situation, and that was the only chance in this case. The only chance that Weaver was going to get a certificate of deposit back is, in fact, if Columbus somehow was going to make it. So we would submit that whether you call it an investment contract or whether you call it a profit sharing agreement or a certificate of interest, that there is at least under Rule 56, a factual issue that would allow a court or jury to make a conclusion that investment contracts or one of these other subspecies, in fact, exists. And I think that the arguments about there not being a common enterprise are not correct. There was, in fact, a pooling of assets, a true pooling of assets. There was no specific segregation of Weaver's investment from Mr. Picarillo's investment, and the third element is made, would be satisfied in a full trial. We would submit that the Third Circuit is correct, that there are factual support for our position that the Picarillo agreement is a profit-sharing agreement or a certificate of interest or investment contract. That in this particular case, the Third Circuit is also correct that the certificate of deposit in this secondary transaction was made by an investor for investment purposes, that it was in fact a sale. This particular court held that in the Rubin case, that even though it was a loan transaction, the person got convicted under Section 17 when they made a pledge, and that was just as much a commercial loan as this particular case. And if it applies in a criminal case, it certainly would apply in a civil case. And we would submit that the Third Circuit was correct in directing the district court to remand the case to hear the pendent state court claims. And we would submit that under Rosado versus Wyman, that would be the outcome no matter what this particular court would decide on the federal securities questions. Thank you very much.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Miller?
I didn't ask for any time for rebuttal, but I accept your invitation to make one comment.
There's no compulsion about it.
I'll say that there are a series of cases, the note and mortgage cases, and all of them in the circuit courts have decided generally that a note and mortgage situation referenced by Justice Powell and Justice Stevens were not securities. In response to one of the questions concerning the existence of the state court action, it is my clear understanding that the cases were filed in the state court on a timely basis, but were not served on Marine Bank on a timely basis, and therefore they are out of time as far as the state court action goes.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...